Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Somehow that reggae beat seems to transition into our opening subject pretty well.
You think? Well, maybe some folks wouldn't necessarily like that kind of association, but nevertheless, we're going to talk about it for the moment. Now, what we're going to talk about is this: how to make the logistics meet up with the law. That has been the central question about Hawaii's medical marijuana policy. Since 2000, Hawaii has had a medical marijuana law, but crafting the mechanism for distribution, oversight, the responsibility of a primary care physician, and allowable amounts have taken almost 15 years. James Anthony is a Hawaii and California licensed attorney and a former prosecutor for the city of Oakland. He specializes in medical marijuana dispensary land use and is in Hawaii to talk about Hawaii's policy at several statewide meetings. James Anthony joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And should we say to you, welcome home, too?
Yes, I'm home. I'm actually right now sitting in my mother's hometown of Hilo, although I grew up in Manoa and in Ava on Oahu.
So lest anyone think that you're just another mainland guy coming here to tell us a whole bunch of stuff, you know where you speak.
I think I understand not only the various options of medical marijuana policy as found in different states and local governments around the United States, but I'm also sensitive to the very, very special and unique circumstances in Hawaii, not only as a state, but really island by island and county by county.
How would you characterize those unique differences?
Well, I think in Hawaii we have an opportunity to craft a system that is really responsive to the needs of local patients and responsive to the special situation of each county. I don't think the Big Island is going to look like Honolulu when it comes to medical marijuana access, production, and distribution, and nor should it. And the other very, very important part of Hawaii's circumstances is that this is an agricultural state. We're talking about an agricultural product. I mean, somehow this policy discussion sometimes ends up sounding like we're discussing plutonium. You know, it's got to be handled inside under maximum security with 3-foot thick concrete walls. And certainly there needs to be a reasonable amount of security. But, you know, we have very many valuable agricultural products in Hawaii that are grown securely and safely and are not diverted in any way. So I think we need to remember that we need to enjoy and respect our access to fresh water, good soil, and plenty of sunshine. And that's where the best medicine comes from.
So you're talking about not only our agricultural differences here in Hawaii, and certainly island by island, but also different needs of patients island to island. How do you see those needs as being different from someone who is in California?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is that we have a particular distribution of patients at the moment under the current circumstances, right? You've got about 13,000 patients, licensed, blue card carrying Hawaii medical marijuana patients across the state. Half of that 13,000 is on the Big Island, you know, which is a little unusual proportionally. But if you think about it, at the moment, the only reason to have a blue card is if you are going to grow your own medicine, or if you have one person who's going to grow it for you and only for you. That is a very awkward system if you are sick and then suddenly you have to start growing your medicine or get somebody to grow it for you. And maybe if you're lucky in about 8 months, you might have something, right? Generally speaking, if you're sick and you need medicine, you need it now. And the only way to get it now is to go to the underground market, right? The system is completely non-workable in that way. So you find that people get cards where they can actually grow, right? Which tends to be not in city and county of Honolulu, but in the other counties. That will change. Once there are medical marijuana dispensaries where you can buy your medicine with your blue card, then there is a reason to get a blue card. And more people who need them will go get them because it'll be a functional system. We've seen this in state after state. Colorado started out with about 6,000 patients, and then as they created the dispensary system, within 2 years, that had blown up to 10 times more than that, 15 times more than that, 60,000 patients, 80,000, 100,000 patients. So you have to create a reason, an incentive, a system that works, and then people will get the card. The other thing to keep in mind, of course, if you want to, you know, you mentioned California as a comparison. Well, the interesting thing about Hawaii is that on any given day, there are tens of thousands of Californians visiting Hawaii. And we know that there are 1 million medical marijuana patients in California. So you have to figure that, you know, several hundred, if not, you know, thousands or more, of those California patients and patients from other states are in Hawaii on any given day. Do they have their medicine with them? Did they bring it on the airplane? Probably not. And then they get here, and there is zero medical hospitality for them. There is no recognition, no reciprocity. That's wrong. That's shameful. We need to do something about that.
As you talk about an increase in the business side of it, actually people who are going to need to purchase this from a dispensary, there's also the question of, well, what do you do to be able to keep those dispensaries in business? What do you suggest for that?
Well, you know, it depends how they're set up. I mean, in most states, there's kind of a split between the different states. Some of them are being operated for-profit. Some of them are being operated not-for-profit. Functionally, they end up being about the same thing. I mean, you know, the thing with a nonprofit isn't that it can't make a profit. If your revenues are less than your expenses are more than your revenues, you're not a nonprofit. You're bankrupt is what you are. Plenty of nonprofits make big money. I'm a member of Kaiser Permanente. I give them money every month. I never go down there. I know they're making money on me, right? They did $22.5 billion in revenue last year, and I don't think they spent that much money. What makes a nonprofit at law, or at least what they told me in law school, is that there's no owner. There's no shareholder, so the profits don't get distributed. They should really be called non-distributors. Right, so that money cannot go to the owners as a dividend or a draw or return on investment. It has to stay inside. Now, obviously, people get paid salaries, the rent gets paid, the mortgage gets paid. All of the reasonable expenses get paid, but there's just nobody, you know, taking the money off the top. So in both of those cases, they have to be run sensibly like businesses that are going to balance the books. The question is, do you do it on a kind of a small local scale where you try to encourage some diversity and some competition among the available sources? Or are you just going to throw it open to whoever's, you know, the biggest guy with the most money, which is sort of what we're seeing in Nevada right now. Nevada is just received all their applications. In November, they're going to issue their licenses for cultivation, products manufacturing, and retail stores. So probably by February or March, they'll be open for business.
James, we're going to have to go.
Very clearly for-profit system. So that'll be an interesting example.
Now, we're going to have to go in just a second, but I want to get your quick take on this. What about oversight of all of this? I mean, this is going to be moving very quickly from the Department of Safety to public safety, to public health.
Well, you know, they've taken 2 years, actually. The both the legislature and both departments have been very deliberate. So that law passed, not this last session, this year, but last year's session, 2013, in April.
But they have until January 1 to make that complete.
January 1 is the official transition date. But both departments have been very cooperative. Public safety has done a really good job of facilitating the transition. Peter Whitaker in the health department, who's overseeing their side, has had 2 years to ramp this up. He's hired somebody to help oversee the thing. I'm very impressed by the job they've done. And now we have this task force that is meeting to work on these issues. And it's very clear that the health department is in the lead and will work with other agencies.
Right, and we've talked with him. I'm just looking for your take on this very, very briefly, because we're going to have to go in just a second. So from your perspective, Hawaii's doing pretty well with this, and this has a good shot of actually coming to fruition fairly soon?
I think so. I think now is the time. The task force will deliver a workable draft to the legislature. It's the legislature's job to finalize that, for the governor to sign it, and then for the health department and the other agencies to implement it this upcoming year, 2015.
All right. I wish we had more time to talk. Perhaps we'll be able to do that in the future. Meanwhile, enjoy being home and all the statewide meetings that you're going to be speaking to folks who have a lot of similar questions. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, if you look for Medical Cannabis Coalition of Hawaii online, you can find all of our events at mcchi.org.
All right, we'll
Thanks
put that
so
on our Facebook page.
Us.
Absolutely. James Anthony is an attorney licensed in California and Hawaii, and he also holds a California real estate broker license. For 9 years, he's had successful experience in medical marijuana permitting, lobbying, regulation, and litigation in California and other states.
Umau, Ukahola, O Hawaii.